Up first, though, we hop on board the telephone line to welcome in, as we do each Tuesday afternoon, our friend, author Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Rich?
Well, I'm just doing my thing here. One more week without Carrie, and then he'll return, and my life will be so much easier. I can sit here with my feet up, just waiting for things to happen like I usually do.
Everything will be comfortable. Your anxiety will decrease.
Yeah, and, you know, there's not. How much anxiety is it? It's AM radio in Bangor, Maine. It's not terribly stressful, but, you know, you get used to doing things a certain way.
Was that a shout-out to the people and the assisted living? So what's up?
Just to let them know, I'll be joining them before too long.
Oh, Kimball, don't have that defeatist attitude. That's going to hasten the aging process. You want to be motivated to stick around and chase the boy around the backyard as long as you can.
No, that's my plan. I told him I'm going to live long enough to be an irritation to him, and he looked at me like, it's time. It's already happened.
Have you set a death or an anti-death goal? Do you have a number you want to meet?
Well, the number actually is, yeah, I don't want to. I'm just going to stay around and really tick people off and never go. But the betting odds aren't great on that. No, I don't have a number. I think a lot of it depends. I don't know, maybe other people feel this way. Am I in decent enough health? Do I know that I'm even here? Who knows? I take it a day at a time. Every day is a gift, a reward, which I say sort of tongue-in-cheek, and yet, you know, my mom died when she was pretty young, so I'm living on extra time and have been for a while.
Well, I believe in you, Kimball.
Thank you. Fine. I appreciate that. Well, you know, I'm doing the right things. I am no Zulu warrior by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, getting out there, getting my exercise in, drinking the water, eating right, doing the things you can do to improve your odds.
Yeah, you have a very laissez-faire attitude. The Zulu in me is, I don't know. I'm just going to try to be supportive. You go get them, Kimball.
I just, you know, like everything else, moderation in all things here for me. I'm convinced that if I don't live longer, it will just make it seem longer if I do that.
Yes, I'm sure it'll turn out fine in the end, either way.
I think about it. Get me through today, and then we'll worry about tomorrow. Well, much to talk about here this afternoon. We've got a number of different topics, some music that we'll get to in a little bit. But let's start with a couple terrific episodes of some classic radio and another one from Nightbeat. Now, this is a terrific one. Randy Stone dealing with a fighter, an old fighter by the name of Billy the Kid, played wonderfully by William Conrad.
Played shockingly, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah.
You didn't get the heads up. If a person didn't get the heads up that was William Conrad, there's a good chance that you wouldn't know that was William Conrad. It's really unlike anything I've ever heard him do. And even though he plays one character, a punch-drunk boxer in this particular episode, if you listen closely, you don't even have to listen that closely, it's two versions of the same character. There's the present-day version, especially Punch Drunk, and there's the flashback version where he was en route to being Punch Drunk but wasn't completely there. So our man of the night goes down to the gym, and he's hanging out, and this is back in the day when people, you just would hang out at the gym and guys would box, and I feel like he would smoke a cigar and spit on the ground. That was approved of, and That sort of, like, probably there was sawdust on the ground, you know what I mean?
Right.
Bits and the tobacco and the blood. And he's hanging out, and he gets popped. He gets beat up by the William Conrad character, and they're going to institutionalize this guy. He's going away, and he is a former champion boxer. And he leaves the crime scene, as it were, and he's tracked down later by our main character, and he's panhandling. He has no recollection that he popped this guy a little while before, and he's trying to get $15 in order to buy a suit to do something that's never a good idea to do. Kimball, you know what I'm talking about. Once it's all over with a lady, it's best to, it's just not worth it. It's never good. And this is a bad lady. It seems to be like the one that you always try to go back to is like a terrible person too. So this is a terrible person, and it's not going to go really well. But William Conrad gives this performance of being punched drunk that I've spent many hours listening to William Conrad on the radio. I have never heard him sound like this. If I wasn't paying close attention, I wouldn't have thought it was him.
No, I wouldn't have known either if you hadn't told me in advance. And, you know, I grew up watching William Conrad in Cannon, and then was it Jake and the Fat Man? He was good. I think he got a couple Emmy Awards for those. But, well, you can make a pretty good case that his best work was done long before television.
I think easily. I think his artistry, he was a radio artist. And when he got the roles in television, they were voice roles. Sounds sort of strange maybe to say because you're looking at someone on TV. But if he didn't have that voice, I know he has the bulk and that was part of his characters often. When he was in film noir, these bit parts in film noir in mid-century times, he was playing the heavy. It wasn't like a pun, but his size worked for him in that role. Just as that size worked against him when he wanted to be cast in the television version of Gunsmoke. But funny, maybe, I don't know, alarming in a different way, the way we sort of look at weight then versus weight now. Because you wouldn't even think anything if you saw, he's probably like smaller than average guy, well, here in the North End, walking around than what I see. But at the time, it was almost like punchline type of stuff that this was a hefty man. So he was Marshall Dillon for me in the same way that, I don't know, Basil Rathbone or Jeremy Brett was Sherlock Holmes. He embodied that character even more than James Arnest did on TV. But he's doing things with his voice, and that voice is dovetailing with the narrative of this punch-drunk boxer. And he goes back in the flashback sequence. And he's with this woman, and he comes home, and he wins. He's the champion now. She just could not care less about this. And when she dresses him down, it's one of the more uncomfortable moments in all of the radio I've ever heard, because there's nothing he can say to stop the flow of her cruelty. I mean, it's cruel. It's just flat out. There's a difference between mean and cruel. Mean's not good. Cruel is worse. This is cruel.
And I did not see the ending coming. I won't give it away, but man, it was heartbreaking.
Yeah, because he's unaware. We're set up for it in a way with what happens at the very beginning when he has no recollection of a beatdown of one punch, and this ending probably went along the same line of it just would have taken a punch, and he has no idea of what he's even done. So it's a piece where the villain is sort of the victim. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Is the there's one bad person in this. The cops aren't bad. They're understanding. They're even empathetic. It's this woman, and she is the one who's going to have he has a bad outcome too, but his outcome, I don't know, because he's all gone, and she wasn't all gone when what happens to her, but at the same time, Kimberly, you know what? Good riddance.
Yeah, she had it coming is what I would say without giving it away here. Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. From there to another terrific radio episode, this time of Suspense, the Dunwich Horror with Ronald Colman. And man, this was creepy and fun. And I don't know who was playing Wilbur Wakely, but he was great.
They say that you're the Ronald Colman of modern day man radio.
Yes. I've heard that myself. Yes.
Yeah. We must listen.
Was it the Gary Colman? I was one of those. I don't know.
This was an ambitious adaptation to take something as prolix as the Dunwich Horror by Lovecraft. Lovecraft was a man who liked to use a lot of words. And to put this into a less than half hour episode of Suspense, you have this this almost like Lenny of Mice and Men type of character with Wilbur and these spells that he wants to get a hold of to help his sort of family situation where one of his relatives doesn't quite fit in the house anymore, and there's cows and all this weird stuff is going on. But in some ways, it's a man or a monster's quest to take a book out from the library. Like, ironically, and this would have been something that appealed to Lovecraft himself immensely. Lovecraft loved nothing more than books, old libraries, the antiquarian life, and Ronald Coleman is this librarian who stymies the effort to get this, well, essentially a book of spells. And not only, it's a rare book, and yes. And the family that needs to have the spells put into practice, they're like missing a crucial page. You know how that is with your incantation book. And so not only does he stop them from getting the book of spells, he stymies them in their efforts at other libraries by putting the call out. So I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, and it's the description of Wilbur, was it eight feet tall and hairy? The whippoorwills, man, the whippoorwills, they freaked me out.
Birds are always, you can do a lot with birds. And Lovecraft usually goes for larger horrors than the sounds of our avian friends. So that makes a nice touch here. And I think one of my favorite parts of the story itself is that the house, the farmhouse, has to be modified. There's something creepy about actually adjusting the space, like the architecture, to sort of house the horror. Like, you know, horror has really gotten out of control when, like, you have to add on to have it fit into your house. You'd think, like, you'd raise the house or you'd set the house on fire, and they're like, no, let's do an addition. Really getting tight in here. So that's something that I thought was clever. I mean, Lovecraft is someone who is, I look at some of these stories. I've read everything by Lovecraft, and he sort of writes stories the way that I thought about fiction in, like, second grade. And it's not much more sophisticated than that. He just comes up like with some monsters and jams them together and fictionalizes places like Springfield and Salem and Manchester by the Sea. But it just goes to show you can be so rudimentary sometimes with horror, and people would be like, oh, wow, that was like a touchstone of the genre. But I don't know. There's a lot more of the bark than the bite, I would say, typically to Lovecraft.
Now, I haven't read the original. Was it a pretty faithful adaptation? Obviously, one that had to be greatly reduced.
The reduction makes it... It was faithful, I'd say, in intent, but also faltering in that faithfulness to the adaptation, because you really have to reduce it so much. And, you know, this was a bit different than what you typically got from suspense. This was more of an escape sort of... radio episode, I'd say. Escape would specialize in these adaptations that were pretty faithful. Suspense would be like a yarn, and it could be lurid and over the top, and then you get the twist at the end. Suspense didn't do a lot with the so-called literary classics. So this is the type of one that, like, when you dimly remember it and you think, isn't there like a 1945 radio adaptation of the Dunwich Horror? When you, like, look it up again, if you need to, you're sort of, like, taken aback that it was suspense, because it's not what we would normally get from suspense. I don't know. Maybe Ronald Coleman insisted upon it or something like that.
All right, from some classic radio to some sublime sounds, let's give a listen here. Colin, of course, the author of the terrific book, Sam Cooke Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. If that one doesn't soothe your soul, man, I don't know what will.
Towards the end of Sam Cooke's life, that was released as a single in the summer of 1964. So he was going to die in December of 64. And the Rolling Stones covered that song. A lot of people probably now would know it first from them, from Out of Our Heads. When I was a kid, when I was very young, like 3 or 4 years old, I just thought it was endlessly hilarious, that joke. My dad told it to me about why did the man throw the clock out the window so he could see time fly. Oh, you could just amuse me so much with that. I'd be like, do it again, man. Do it again. That's a good one. And then he probably was so annoyed. That notion of anti-temporality, sort of inverted Proust that we get with this song when Cook sings, it might be 1 o'clock and it might be three. Time don't mean that much to me. Now that is, remember that Bob Dylan album with he's walking down the road like in Greenwich Village. And he has his girlfriend with him and she's clinging to him. He's freestyling.
Yeah, was that the Freewheeling Bob Dylan? Was that that album?
Yeah. He's freestyling and freewheeling. This is the Sam Cooke version of that with time. He's dislocated, the narrator of the song has dislocated himself from the time-space continuum because he's so present in something else. And it's really smart when you think about it that way. It's a soulful song, but it's a song of a richly textured philosophy in a line like that. And Sam Cooke could write lines like that. And we don't, well, I do, obviously, and I wrote largely a book about the lines that he wrote of this nature, but we tend not to think of him as writing lines like that, where it's almost an adage in and of itself. So this is one of those Sam Cooke songs that really people just don't know that much now. It is not featured on oldies radio or whatever his usurped oldies radio. I'm sure like there are all these stations on your cable and you can just go to channel 523 or whatever and they play the oldies. This never really gets aired on anything. So it's like a cool Sam Cooke song to know that most people just wouldn't unless they're seeking out Sam Cooke.
And I love the line, I might not feel this good again.
Well, it sort of echoes your day at a time philosophy. I don't know, Kimball. To me, it's a little defeatist. I'm looking triple digits. I'm looking beyond triple digits. I know the line that I want to get to is bare minimum. I'm thinking, okay, today, if I ever had a good day, I'd want to see how I'd want to better it tomorrow. So I'm not saying that Sam Cooke isn't, that the narrator is not thinking that way. But again, it's a song about more than anything. And this is just an underrated skill. It's a song about being present in the moment. We are lousy at that now. Like if someone said to me, like, oh, I wanted to go get an MFA and learn how to write and spend all these years. I said, no, you suck. If you even think that way, there's no way you could ever write well. It'll never happen. But save your money or give it to me, and here's all you need to know. Learn to be in the moment. That really is like the key to doing anything well at any level of high quality. So this is a soul song about it, tucked away as this single from the summer of 1964. It's like a decent-sized hit. And it's just so smart and smooth and silky, but at the same time, it's real. Sometimes we get smooth and silky, and it's not very real. It's kind of glossy. I don't know. Smokey Robinson, I don't know how real that ever really gets. Sam Cooke, he just excelled at keeping it real.
Let's go from there to a Stones bootleg from Paris in April of 1965. And you were saying this is one of the first Stones bootlegs you ever had?
It was. I tracked this down as a teenager. And it wasn't like you could just go to, you know, like when you would leave the dentist as a kid, maybe there'd be like a little treasure chest and you'd go pick something out. And
right. It's
the most magical chest in the world. That's kind of like what YouTube is now. You just type in like The Who, Boston, 1969. It's just the treasure chest. But it didn't used to be like that. And bootlegs that you found, it's not like there was an internet to consult, or there were guidebooks or anything like that. So when you came across something like the early Stones, they don't even do Satisfaction at this show. So it's before that, a little bit. You see the set list, and it's so Pavlovian. It's like, you're salivating. It's like, are you kidding me? They're doing Hey Crawdaddy to close this sucker? They don't even do that on record, they're doing Little Red Rooster in front of these crazy Parisians. And
And do a great cover of Route 66.
Yes, that too. It's the Rolling Stones as, things change so much from now at this particular time of this recording to like 1966 when they're these sonic futurists. But here is kind of their last moment as a rhythm and blues band. And this is just, it makes sense that they covered Sam Cooke's Good Times. And it makes sense that they're this hard-charging, primal, primitive rhythm and blues band at this show. And like sort of, I don't know, I feel like you think of it as like Tony, like fancy Paris. And here they are doing this American rhythm and blues via like London. Kind of strange. And here we are in France. And I remember playing this for the first time, and I could not believe that this existed. It still is so exciting to me, but it was especially exciting at the time, maybe like for different reasons, this confirmation that here was such a thing. And I found that listening to recordings of this nature, they tell you as much, if not more, about a band like this than the Aftermath or any album, Beggar's Banquet, that you might care to think of. They're like the glue recordings. They're the natural recordings, not the, okay, we're officially doing this kind of things. It's almost like you see these people, they're out in the world and they pretend to be good people on social media, but they're absolutely rubbish in the downtime. And it's the downtime that tells. And this is the downtime for the Rolling Stones. And it tells in like the biggest, baddest, like most intense rhythm and bluesy way.
Another great live recording from one of the most fondly remembered concert stretches, I think, here in New England history, the Boston Tea Party, 1969, and a heck of a set from Led Zeppelin.
It's the last show of their run at the Tea Party. In January of 69, so this is January 26th, and it's a portion of the first set. Now, the legend has it that they played for 4.5 hours. I don't know how true this is, how when people recall things, Bill Mazeroski didn't just hit the ball over the wall in 1960. It cleared it by like 50 feet, and 9 million people who weren't there were there. So you have some of that going on here. But as we've spoken about before, and I get in a lot of trouble, I get quite a bit of hate mail. And I think it's because I think Led Zeppelin is a really bad band, but I like them a lot. And there isn't literally a Led Zeppelin recording that I don't have, like thousands studio. Everything that they ever, like someone taped, I have somewhere. So there's a difference between liking something and maybe thinking something is great. Like, I'm a guy, if Perfect Strangers started showing on MeTV, I'd be like, oh yeah, these dogs don't get to watch that Dance of Joy every night. But I'm not like going to say, Kimball, we need to talk about how Perfect Strangers is high art disguised as popular culture. That's probably not going to happen. But this is Zeppelin when they were just lusty and trying to make it and were unsure if they were going to, and they were kind of throwing it together and sweating through the set. They weren't doing like the prog sort of heavy metal that they were doing later, or even the stuff of Led Zeppelin IV. They were just, again, a sort of rhythm and blues band that was playing heavy metal and stealing from people and going for it and just throwing it together and hoping it worked on gumption and balls, and it did.
And in both cases, I feel like it was a pair of bands before success spoiled them.
Yeah. The Stones wouldn't really be spoiled. It took a while for the Stones to be spoiled by success. It would be in the, after around the time or just after Goat's Head Soup. They still toured really well, maybe their best touring after Goat's Head Soup. But you get into the mid-70s, and it's just not going to go so well. But they had a run. You think about like the shelf life for a band, and that was a really long sort of creative, you know how we're always like talking about Hall of Fame players or potential Hall of Fame players in baseball, and we look at things like prime and peak And they're different. Prime and peak are different. The Stones, their prime and peak went on for a really long time together, overlapping, so far as bands go, longer than it did for the Beatles, for instance. Zeppelin, once you get out of 1972 and shows they're going to do it, there's a show from Seattle in 1972, for instance. It's a lot like this show at the Tea Party in Boston in 69. Same kind of energy, same kind of improvised spirit, with like shouting out to the audience what you want to hear and then trying to do it. But then they're going to start to get into stuff like the double album and like, okay, we're doing Moby Dick for 30 minutes in Madison Square Garden. And like, I can listen to all of that and enjoy it, but it's not, it doesn't have the same spiritedness of just, I don't know, I feel like once security enters into things for some time, for some people sometimes, they're kind of cooked creatively. And it's not like Zeppelin was like that great creatively, but there was a drive. There was an energy to them that you hear, especially, I would say, on this bootleg.
And finally, terrific recording, early recording of the Yardbirds, 1964, five live Yardbirds, a terrific version of Too Much Monkey Business with, man, a great vocal by the underrated Keith Relf.
Keith Relf is one of my five or six favorite singers of all time, and he is always flagged off as being a bad singer by everybody. I love his voice. I love the way, again, he embraces that voice, and he goes for it. And the Yardbirds were a band that Led Zeppelin grew out of. The Yardbirds are one of our greatest bands who could paste Led Zeppelin. And they're not even at the level they're going to get to at their zenith, which will require Jeff Beck coming along and replacing Eric Clapton. Clapton is the guitarist here. And this was very daring at the time. I mean, now, I don't know what people know about history, but like everyone kind of takes like, I sound like some country artist, like some boob from like behind a trailer. And he has like this live album coming out. It's like a double album. It's like live behind the Walmart or whatever it's called. And it just was so token. It came up in my Facebook news. It seemed like a big deal. Does anyone care? Like, oh, I need that, where he sort of like does his hits. This is 1964. There weren't live albums in rock and roll. It just, the technology didn't really exist for it. The Yardbirds were in this favorable situation where it's not like they were playing stadiums. They weren't like that big. This is a club. So in a way, it's not that different than a jazz live recording. But remember, jazz at the time was acoustic. And everyone was sitting on their hands and clapping at the end. That's not what was going down at this smoky rhythm and blues lager-filled club in London. And so you're getting their set at the time. It was made for next to nothing. And it's the Yardbirds as the Yardbirds were. And this is another album I came to like as a teenager that thrilled me. It still does. And that version, like you said, of Too Much Monkey Business, the Chuck Berry number, the Beatles did a great version of it too. It really suited Keith Relf's vocal delivery, where he could go for it, and he was an excellent harmonica player. He was like the one of the best, if not the best, in rock and rhythm and blues at the time.
Colin Fleming joins us every Tuesday afternoon here on Downtown. Colin, thank you much as always.